Good morning. This is Doug Harned, and I'm really excited today to have with us Robert Korn. Robert and I have known each other a long time. He is the president of the Carlisle Aviation Group, and before that, that was Apollo Aviation, if you've heard it as that. And he's been through a long history in the industry, which I am frankly not going to attempt to go through here, but I think I consider Robert to be one of the most insightful people in around aircraft finance and just a lot of the issues around how you think about aircraft demand, engine demand, MRO, all of those things. So with that, Robert, maybe you can say a few words about Carlisle.
Sure. Well, good morning, everybody. As Doug said, you know, our business originally founded right after 9/11 as Apollo Aviation Group has now operated through two entire cycles, and we're entering our third. We were thrilled, my partner Bill Hoffman and I, to join the Carlisle Group when we sold the business to them at the end of 2018. So we're in our second year operating as Carlisle Aviation Partners as a wholly owned company and part of the Carlisle Group's credit group.
Now, with us today, we also have Dave Vernon, who covers North American transports, and also Cherry Lung, that is Asian transports. They'll have a couple questions later on in this. And if you have questions listening, please just email them to me at douglas.harned@bernstein.com. And to start off with, Robert, you know, since you've been through two of these cycles, and I have to say I've been through them too, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you look at the current situation.
Yeah.
And think about that in comparison to the global financial crisis and post
9/11. Yeah, well, you know, I've been doing a lot of reading and watching a lot of people talk about, you know, when the recovery is going to happen. And, you know, there's a lot of different predictions, and they're really based on historical activity. You know, so as we're experts in this business, but we're not fortune tellers, you know, our best bet is to look back to 9/11, where, you know, there was an immediate demand drop off driven by, you know, by fear and by terrorism. And it really took the removal of that fear to get people comfortable to fly again quickly, as well as demand was stimulated by fare pricing and economic recovery. And I think it took roughly 2.5 to 3 years to get traffic back going, and profitability was even more delayed due to fare stimulation by the airlines. That also wasn't global like this is. You know, the global financial crisis was not in many respects as severe. It was driven by a financial system meltdown. But we saw very similar traits where you had a small drop off in demand. We got well off of our annual 4.5% traffic growth. And it took, you know, 3 to 4 years to get us back on track. So when I read and I see people talk about 2023 as when we expect to be back on track as an industry, I think we're pointing to what we look at retrospectively. And we're in an environment where it's a much deeper and different type of activity. So we're gonna really have to watch and see how recoveries occur.
Well, you know, one of the things we have right now is, you know, the majority of the global fleet is parked. And obviously airlines are extraordinarily cash strapped, doing everything they can to protect cash. When you think of the decisions that airlines are trying to make today between, do I take this new airplane that I've ordered from Airbus or Boeing, I've already paid in for some of it, and I have that choice, or I have a choice of keeping my older airplanes that I already have that maybe, you know, fully depreciated. How do you see airlines making that trade-off?
Well, everything today, first of all, you know, we're still, as you said, we're on the ground. Every decision that is being made today is about cash preservation. So airlines are looking for all ways to reduce cost, reduce cash in the immediacy. So, you know, I think if I would if I was an airline today, I'd be looking at what's the way to hunker down, to save as much cash, and then to make a plan moving forward that allows me to reduce cash burn to zero as quickly as possible. And that very well may be a manner where deliveries are deferred.
Now, we've seen a lot of airlines so far. I mean, clearly a lot of, everything we see is airlines pushing to defer deliveries, not necessarily cancel them, but at least push them out. But we're also seeing a lot of airlines talk about, you know, retiring aircraft and 757s, 67s, you know, A380s. You know, when you look at how airlines are viewing these older assets, what do you, how do you think they're going to approach that?
Well, you know, every airline's different, but I think, you know, what we've seen through every crisis is, you know, with 9/11, it was essentially the permanent retirement of 727s and DC-9s and 737-200s. The global financial crisis, it was the permanent retirement of most 747-200s. I think this is a environment where you're going to see wholesale fleet retirements, which we've already started to see, of prior generation wide bodies, such as 747-400s, A380s, any remaining A340-600s. And we're seeing wholesale fleet announcements on 75s, 76s, MD-80s, MD-90s. So I think that will be a significant driver of finding a equilibrium between supply and demand to see a lot of these older fleets face wholesale retirements.
You know, one of the questions we've had is what happens if this is a in a sense a short versus longer downturn, and by that I mean if you're taking a lot of airplanes, and they may not even be those categories you said, they could be older A320s. If those are parked for an extended period of time, what happens? Does that make it significantly harder to bring those airplanes back?
Yeah, you know, the longer aircraft are stored in the desert by a lessor such as ourselves, the more and more calendar-driven maintenance on the airframes and landing gear, the more and more airworthiness directives and service bulletins and modifications that need to be made become, you know, necessary costs to be paid for before an aircraft can go back into the air. So there's definitely a point where aircraft become less and less financially viable to go back into the air. It may be another situation with large airlines where they park a big fleet and they start to cannibalize, and instead of doing engine overhauls on the portion of the fleet that's still flying, they start to take serviceable engines off of the parked aircraft and start to use them rather than do MRO activity. So definitely, the longer that it's on the ground, the harder it is to bring it back.
Well, it seems like that would particularly be important for something like a 737NG or an A320, where you've got very high value engines.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But, you know, and the difference may be the equation, the analysis may be very different for a midlife to older life lessor like ourselves, who may have a 20 plus year old 737NG versus a lessor that owns 737NGs that are 1 or 2 years old and are parked. So definitely the engines become a much larger percentage of the value on a 20-year-old aircraft than a 1-year-old aircraft.
And we've seen some deals out there where there was a Fortress Avianca deal as an example, where they, you know, they're doing sale leasebacks on those, and then you know, I'm sure at the end of the day, the value's in the engines. Is this something we should expect to see quite a bit of as airlines look to think of ways to monetize their fleet?
Well, this is exactly how we got started in 2003, buying engines out of the retired Delta 727 fleet, and expanding to other fleets. And our business grew in the early 2000s, doing wholesale fleet retirements, as you just described. And I think that you're going to see a lot of these fleets obviously get sold. And, you know, in the case, if I look back to the Fortress Avianca business, you know, what that was a excellent opportunity to retire A318s that really didn't have a desirable next home, but to move those engines over to A320s and A321s, which were definitely continuing aircraft. So I think you'll see where there's optionality in engines, and there's large continuing fleets flying, you'll see this as a real opportunity to recycle and consume aircraft and engines that have been displaced from the operating fleets.
Now when you look at the decisions that an airline's making on whether to, say, buy new or extend the life on existing equipment, how do fuel prices play into that? We've heard some people argue, well, if there are low fuel prices, which we obviously have today, then, you know, there won't be that much of an incentive. They'll try and defer or cancel orders and just look at keeping the old equipment longer. How do you see airlines thinking about that trade-off there?
Well, one thing that, you know, we have over 100 customers and we've been doing this a long time. Certainly, eventually every airline will end up operating the new technology aircraft. And certainly large major carriers will over time introduce and operate both fleets side by side. So we should expect the MAX and the NEO to become the backbone of the major carriers' fleets and eventually all fleets as the NGs ultimately retire. So, you know, those plans are set in place for many, many years. The fact that fuel is low today, and I'm not I don't have a crystal ball, but most airlines will say the same thing and say they can't make long-term plans on short-term movements in fuel cost. So I think this is only one input. It's a great input to negotiate with a lessor when fuel's real low to say it's not worth that much. But at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of other things that the airlines are considering as to whether they defer new deliveries or take them today.
And it's related, but how does carbon fit into this? Because, down at ISTAT, I went to one of the working group sessions on Corsia, and, you know, that was before COVID-19. So sort of went off the page a little bit, but, you know, we already saw, for instance, the French government support for Air France KLM had a contingency in there on environmental.
Right.
And so how do you see airlines thinking about this as they look toward when we ultimately see a return or a recovery?
You know, it's a great question that I'm not really sure I can answer wholly. Our whole industry is working towards reducing our carbon footprint. Certainly the newer technology engines and aircraft go farther than any prior equipment. So if you're very interested in that, you're going to be favoring towards new aircraft, and eventually we're going to get there. But I don't think you'll see wholesale retirements of 737 NGs tomorrow.
Right.
But I will point out that those other types of fleets, those last generation aircraft like 75, 76, A340, 600s, A310s, and A330s, as those retire, which you'll see wholesale fleet retirements, that will significantly change the carbon footprint of the world fleet just by this pandemic.
Yeah. And when you look around the world, are you, We've been talking sort of in general about how airlines make these decisions, but if you look around the world, I think of this in two ways. One are sort of business models, and the other one would be region. Do you see differences in how this is approached by, say, you know, LCCs in Asia versus, you know, large network carriers in, you know, in developed countries, for example?
Yeah, well, certainly each carrier has its own characteristics, and that determines how they're going to find their way through this this current environment. And, you know, so we're watching regionally, we're watching the different types of carriers. We're watching, you know, how does state aid come in different countries to help the airlines? How do they restart? You know, clearly in China and the US, I believe roughly, they control roughly 65% of the global domestic traffic. So, you know, a US airline versus a Singaporean airline has a chance to operate a domestic network today, even while borders are shut. So, you know, every by jurisdiction, we're going to see different ways that airlines restart operations today and going forward.
You know, as airlines look at this, and as you talked about, preservation of cash is critical. What do you see out there as sort of the financing opportunities today? I mean, in like ABS market is sort of, you know, vaporized. You know, what are the things that people can look to today as ways to get financing?
Right. Well, I mean, I think what we're going to see is, and hopefully we're already starting to see, is a renewed involvement of the OEMs in financing their products, as well as the government supported EXIMs and ECAs getting back involved into aircraft finance, similar to how they have in the prior downturns, to facilitate these aircraft being delivered. I think until the banking system gets more comfortable than they are right now, I think it's going to be challenging without that support to have the OEMs achieve their sales networks.
And yeah, that absolutely seems that way. If how do you see the lessor industry right now? You compare it to after the global financial crisis, they were a lot more leveraged coming out of that. But you know, clearly we've seen, you know, big asset value declines. You know, this is not easy either. How would you think about the lessor universe today and its ability to participate in this?
Well, we have today, as compared to the global financial crisis, we have much larger lessors with much stronger balance sheets, much stronger liquidity profiles, and with a lot of that experience of how they navigated through the last crisis. So these businesses, and there's many, many more of them today than there were, and they're more global, I think are much better equipped to move through this this business cycle in a real productive manner. I think with a lot of support on the debt side from these ECAs and EXIM banks, we hopefully will see a real solid recovery this year.
And a couple of questions came in, and it's a question I have as well, that relate to sort of asset values. I mean, you know, it's a tough time right now. How do you see asset values trending? And I would say, you know, sort of in production aircraft and, you know, sort of older midlife, how do you see those values trending during this environment?
Well, I think we'll see something very similar to what we've seen in the last two crises. You know, we've talked about 9/11 and the global financial crisis. So what we saw was between the first 9 to 12 months of the crisis, the asset values slide, and then they stay stable at that low level for between 1 to 2 years, and then start a gradual recovery that takes another 2 to 3 years. What we saw was those drops could be anywhere between 10 and 20% on in production aircraft, historically, I'm speaking of 737-800s and A320s. And what we saw was those values eventually recovered, and those fleets, those rates all came back. When it took a total of 3 years to 5 years, it really will be depending on the way traffic recovers. In the case of aircraft that are these older vintage airplanes that are out of production, you'll see much deeper drops in value, and you won't see a significant amount of recovery because these aircraft will essentially move into the, you know, either the retirement phase globally or sort of end up in freight, like 767s and 757s, and you just won't see a recovery similar to what you'll see in the kind of traditional mainline aircraft.
And can you contrast that in sort of narrow body versus wide body?
Well, I think it's going to be similar. I mean, we've seen that, you know, A330s historically recovered very well in prior downturns that were the mainline wide bodies during the global financial crisis. Whereas in that case, 747-200s, really slid and really didn't come back. They moved into freight and they were retired and the engines were recycled to other types of equipment. So I think you can expect the similar type of activity where, as we see fleets this time around basically be retired on a wholesale basis, we can expect values to behave directionally very similarly in the ways this happened previously. Whereas fleets that simply are reduced and recover in terms of operation should behave similarly as well.
Well, I want to turn it over to Dave for a bit. Dave, do you have a couple questions there?
Yeah, I do. Thanks for the commentary on asset values. That's very, very helpful. I guess I was wondering, you know, we have seen quite a number of asset-backed deals done by the U.S. airlines in this crisis to raise liquidity. How would you characterize some of the terms on those deals? Outside of valuation obviously being a little bit depressed because demand is depressed, is it also a situation where the terms on some of these financing deals will be a lot more onerous or strict because of the demand shortfall right now?
You know, Dave, I apologize. I haven't spent the time to really study those transactions. You know, I mean, we're certainly, we've watched very, very confidently seeing all those deals get accomplished because it's great news for liquidity for all of us in the business to see that investors are still willing to back those transactions, even at a slightly higher rate. So I think that's a positive.
Okay. I guess as you think about maybe how the airlines have the last couple of years been approaching finance and aircraft purchasing and the financing of engines, you know, coming out of the crisis, there's going to be a new need to pay down some of the debt that we've incurred here. How do you think that the strategies towards financing sort of new aircraft and maintenance capex on engines is going to change for the major airlines and coming out of the crisis? Would you see a more leasing versus buying types of decisions, or how are you expecting things to play out?
Certainly, will change the finance versus purchase equation for airlines versus lease. I mean, I think leasing will become, I would expect, a more interesting avenue than it was over the last 4 to 5 years, where there was a lot of interest in providing liquidity to the airlines from the fixed income side of the house. And the airlines were generating exceptional profits that were supporting that. I think we're in a different environment where, you know, where there may be a higher cost that we're already seeing in the fixed income sector, which changes the equation, as well as, you know, the airlines clearly are looking to generate more liquidity now, and leasing may provide them that opportunity. So I think at least in the moment, you know, just like in prior crises, that's what we should expect, not 100%, but I think we should see a more of the opportunity set slide to the lessors.
And I guess just as a follow-up to that, do you think that's going to be, you know, I've actually heard a little bit in the background that some of the commercial airlines are aggressively looking at engine financing deals kind of coming out of the crisis as a way to minimize CapEx.
I'm not involved in any of those transactions. I really can't really speak to that. It's not something we do. We do aircraft specifically. Certainly that's what airlines have done. I think everybody's going to look for ways to generate liquidity and to sell assets. And, certainly there's a lot of value in the engines that these airlines have, and it's an opportunity for them.
Okay. Cherry, do you want to ask a couple questions from the Asian perspective, just to keep us on track?
Here? Yeah, sure. Hi, Robert. Thank you for the comments. And you mentioned about these days compared to the last crisis, the lessors, they are much larger and they have stronger balance sheets with better liquidity. I'm just wondering, is there any changes to the mix of the funding source of the leasing companies after the recent pandemic? And if there is any change to the funding costs, do you see that it will finally be transferred to the airlines in a sense that whether the leasing cost to the airlines you will see that is going to increase or decrease in the future?
Well, I don't think there's been a lot of lessors that have gone out to access the capital markets in the last 90 days. I mean, certainly The lessons learned of the global financial crisis about seeking long-term financing and moving towards unsecured financing, I think has been a very well thought through lesson for these large lessors. Certainly ABS financing for lessors like ourselves has been, I think, a very well thought through strategy to create sustainable financing structures. When it comes to how you, as you said, pass cost on to the airlines, I would say, lessees have strongly benefited from lessors obtaining low cost financing over the last few years. So I would say the reciprocal is that lessors are very, very sophisticated businesses that are in the financial services game. And we provide essentially liquidity to our customers in a manner that allows us to make a profit for our investors. So if our costs go up, we have to offset that with increased revenue to allow us to still deliver the acceptable return to our investors. I think that's what you'll see if in fact funding costs go up.
I see. And you also mentioned that after the pandemic, I mean, airlines obviously want to preserve cash and then hold up on the liquidity. And but at the same time, now that the Chinese airlines, they need to book operating lease on balance sheets after the change of the accounting policy. And how would the airlines actually consider, I mean, beyond liquidity, this which is really important, but beyond that, how would the airlines consider between kind of a purchasing via capital or operating lease? Would they actually prefer one over another, going forward?
Well, this is going to be a decision that each individual airline is going to have to make based on their balance sheet and based on their sponsors. The analysis for the large state-owned Chinese airlines may be very different than the analysis for a large low-cost carrier that's either public or private. So I think each airline, it's a different equation. We'll just have to watch.
Right. And the other, maybe last questions from me on China is that you also mentioned that in China, probably like the big three airlines, they control like 65% of the aircrafts because they basically like domestic is around like 65% of their portfolio. And then we're seeing that after pandemic, domestic recovery is obviously ahead of international because of the pandemic developments in the other markets. And then we don't know when actually international is going to fly off again. And if that happens, it's very likely to be the short haul first, like within Asia, like China to Korea or China to Japan. And how would that, you think, would affect the demand on wide or narrow body aircraft? Because I've heard like mixed saying that normally for domestic we use narrow body, but given now that they want to control the number of flights, then perhaps they actually want to put a bigger aircraft in the air such that you get more spacing, etc. So how do you see that this is going to evolve?
Well, I think that's a short-term, really interesting question. You know, I think we've seen a lot of analysis that's come out from IATA talking about safety being the most important, but also talking about how, you know, airport infrastructure and testing to create safe zones so airlines can start to sell all the seats again to become profitable. Because the reality of it is, you fill up airplanes, it's a very challenging situation for any airline to be profitable. So I think in the short term, certainly we're seeing it on the US side where airlines are restricting the number of seats they're selling to try to sell passengers. I don't see that as something that's viable and sustainable in the long term. But I think we're going through a very unusual short-term situation that isn't necessarily reflective of making a profit in some of these cases. It's re-stimulating demand.
Sure. Yeah. That's reasonable. Yeah. All right. I'll pass it to you back, Doug.
Okay. Thanks. A couple questions have come in here, and they're related to some things we've talked about. One is when you look at the lessors today, you talked about the difference between what they look like post global financial crisis and today. But who do you think will be not by name, but sort of the winners and losers here in terms of you think about all of the new entrants that came in over the last decade to this space, you know, a lot of Chinese lessors, you know, built up businesses here. You roll this forward, do you think you're going to see consolidation in the industry? What will it take to be a winner?
We've seen in every crisis, we've seen consolidation. What's different about our business today than in any other cycle, really one of the reasons when, Bill and I were approached by Mark Jenkins at the Carlyle Group, we realized of literally the top 20 lessors, we were the only one that the two of us stood alone without a big financial backer or without being a public entity. And we realized that, you know, to be able to survive through cycles, this is an incredibly capital intensive business that requires you to be global in the way you operate. And the business space of leasing, the business of OEM selling aircraft, the leasing business, all of what we do has gone from being a North American and European business 20 years ago to fully global, and really the expansion in everything we're doing has been in Asia. And so I think you're going to see the larger parties with really strong support favored over anybody else. So that, I mean, without naming names, I would say this may be a situation where you have the bigger the better, right? But there's also some very, very smart people in our business that will find their way through this because of the patience and the discipline that they put into building their portfolio and how they develop their financing and work with their clients. So I think there's going to be a lot of consolidation. I certainly think there's going to be some pain points for most, if not many, lessors. And I think the business ultimately will emerge from this strike cycle even stronger, just like it has in the case of each other cycle.
Now, it's interesting you say that because I can think of lessors that have come into this space over the last few years with, you know, people that have never seen a downturn, that I think my impression was they didn't understand the kind of contingencies that they would need to have in situations. I mean, my guess is you're suggesting there could, people like that, there could be a shakeout here.
You know, it's interesting. We've been, and you and I have talked, and I've said, you know, I'm probably the, one of the most negative people you've talked to over the last couple of years. I was on a fixed income roadshow, and it was, I think, the third week of January, and a meeting had popped up on my calendar with what I refer to as the royalty of the Carlyle Group. And it was some of the guys that had been there, including one of the founders, Bill Conway, but it was being led by the co-CEOs, Glenn Youngkin and Kyu-Sun Lee. And one of the statements that I remember, and I've repeated this over and over and over the last 3 months, is that they were very concerned that they were seeing signs around the globe in different industries that caused them to be concerned that we should all be, as investment professionals, aware that you know, that the markets seem to be overheating. And one of the points that was made was that, you know, 42% of the investment professionals had been in college during the last global financial crisis. And what they were saying to the people like myself who had been through this was, you know, bring your teams together and warn them and caution them as to what we should expect as we go into a downturn. And I think it was great advice, you know. And to your point, there are a lot of people, because this cycle and expansion has been so long, that there's a lot of people in our industry that don't have the experience that our firm benefits from, having gone through multiple cycles before.
Well, and that was before the pandemic, right? So another question that came in, and it relates to something we talked about before. When you think of all the aircraft being parked today and the cannibalized material, engines in particular, how do you see that affecting the, you know, CFM, affecting Pratt & Whitney as they look to their you know, their engine aftermarket businesses and selling that new material? Are we going to see, I mean, quite honestly, when we look through the global financial crisis, those businesses took a long time to come back because of this issue. How do you see that today?
I mean, I think these are great ways that we learn that, you know, the residual value in these products is really there, because in the case of CFM, who's been building the 5B and the 7B for over 20 years, and, you know, Pratt Whitney, who's been building the V2500 for over 20 years, there's more of those engines in the marketplace continuing to operate for many more years than ever there was a fleet before. So, you know, that's a strong, the fact that those engines can be recycled and the parts consumed is a strong support for these strong residual values that those products have maintained for many years. So, you know, the behavior of, as we talked about earlier, when an aircraft gets to its end of life, a significant majority of the value is those strong engines, both the parts and the serviceable ones. And so you should expect that wise investors that will take advantage of, you know, consuming and earning the residual out of those assets.
And then when you get to aircraft where the engines are, you know, are older, you know, out of production aircraft, I mean, how easy is it to monetize that kind of equipment when you, you know, you're looking at, you see these all the time, right? I mean, how do you deal with some of these older assets, whether they're 757s, 67s, 8340s? I mean, how do you think about those?
That's how we started.
I know.
That's how we started, and it was, you know, piece by piece, life limited part by life limited part, engine by engine. You know, as these fleets shrink, the opportunity to liquidate each individual asset becomes smaller because the fleet becomes smaller. So you have to be small and nimble to liquidate 757 engines today. And whereas if you're doing 737 NG activity, you can probably do it in large, large chunks. And the opportunity doesn't change. It just has to be sized with the size of the remaining fleet.
And then another question here is not a surprising question. We talked about it, the MAX. So the MAX has had obviously a tough road here. With you know your 100 plus customers out there, do you see airlines still committed to the MAX, supportive of getting the MAX? How do you see them viewing it?
Well, you know, we don't own any MAXes or NEOs, but many of our customers have orders on the MAX side, and many of our customers have orders on the NEO side. And I think we can say, you know, unequivocally that all of those customers and both those programs remain committed to what they had planned to do, which is to ultimately take delivery of those types of equipment, right? I think each individual airline has its own very short-term strategy, which, you know, most revolve around what we talked about, which is conserving cash. But, you know, these are, you know, Airbus and Boeing are two amazing large companies that have done really, really great stuff over my career. And so I think you're going to see, you know, as we emerge from this cycle, you know, I think we'll start to get back on track with all of these programs.
And then Dave, I think you've got a question you wanted to ask there.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, we're seeing some wholesale retirements of a lot of different fleet types that a couple of which could be in fairly good demand in the cargo conversion market. I was wondering if you have an opinion on, you know, sort of the pace of activity that we should expect in terms of freighter conversions, just given the feedstock that's going to start to become available in the next couple of years.
Well, I think it's going to be as it has been in prior downturns, the demand for NGs over the last couple of years, as well as the strong values, have prevented certain operators that wanted to get a hold of that feedstock from getting the airplanes at a price that they could convert them and put an aircraft on the ramp at the right price in their mind. Clearly, with more displaced 737 NGs, I think just based on supply and demand, we should expect values to trend down, and therefore that cost on the ramp amount should get closer to what lessors or airlines think is what they need to economically buy those aircraft to put them through conversion.
Yeah, I was wondering also on the 7-6, that was a platform that was very difficult to find feedstock for a number of years. I'm just wondering if that would also be an area where you'd see.
Well, so we don't own any 7-7s, so I can't speak directly to that, but it seems to have become a phenomenally exciting aircraft for most of the major freight operators. And certainly with the announcements we've seen over the last couple of weeks of retirements of fleets, I think those operators ought to be getting pretty excited that they're going to have access to some feedstock they didn't expect.
Great. Thanks.
I've got another question here that relates back to something I asked before, which was on if an airplane is parked, let's say 737NG is parked, and it is, say, 10 years old or, say, 15 years old. The question is, can you give a sense for how long? You had highlighted a lot of the costs of bringing back an airplane once it's parked, but can you give a sense of when it becomes not practical anymore? In other words, 10-year-old to 15-year-old, I mean, how long can they, if they sit there, you know, when do you typically sort of say, we're going to...
It's pretty hard to see a 10-year-old 737-800 be disassembled. I wouldn't say it's never happened. I mean, we did this in the last downturn to I think 6 or 7 year old A318s. But that was a very unusual situation where the aircraft, you know, just wasn't a user for an A320 variant with only 100 seats. When you get to a 737-800 that's extremely efficient, I mean, it's hard to imagine a 10-year-old one being cut up. But, you know, as they get, when I talk about age, I'm talking about, you know, remaining useful life if you're going to invest that money, as well as the percentage of your investment is much more readily recoverable by dispositioning the engines. So if you have a brand new 737NG that is on in your investment portfolio, you know, in the $30 to $40 to $50 million range, you're going to be willing to put money into it to keep it flying. But if you have a 20-year-old one that's in your books for less than $10 million, it's going to be a lot easier to recover your investment from dispositioning the aircraft. Where's it's very challenging to say this year, this time is where the break point is, but you know, we'll spend the time and do the economic analysis on each individual aircraft to ascertain what's the best exit for the investors.
I mean, my assumption would be that when you get to variants that are, say, like A319s or 737-700s, you know, then you start to get to things that can push that timing forward a little bit, I would expect.
Well, that, I mean, that's what we see, as you know, with retirements. We see that the largest variants of these families seem to have the most longevity, you know, in how long they stay in business. I think that's very similar, because if you can get a 737-800 or a 700, I think generally an operator is going to pick the 800 just because same price on the ramp, but more seats.
Well, I don't have any more here, but I just like to wrap up with one, with sort of a final question where to use your crystal ball. And if you think about the future, next 5 years, 5 years from now, what do you think the industry will look like in terms of, you know, the kinds of airlines that may be winners and losers in this, the and the way that you're approaching it in your business?
Well, I think we're going to see continued consolidation on the airline side. I think just because of, that's what we've been seeing. We've watched over the last 20 years strong consolidation in the U.S., down from a lot of players to a few. I think we have seen and heard many people speculate that we'll see some form of that in Europe. And I think stronger, larger companies have buying and buying power that far exceeds small companies. So I think we'll see that. We've seen that on the lessor side, right? Where we've seen larger and larger and stronger lessors that are even better capitalized than before. So I think those are two strong trends we'll see. I firmly believe people will be back traveling, right? And that'll be a good thing for the industry, right? And I think we'll continue to see these strong programs deliver aircraft for many, many years to these airlines.
Well, great. Well, Robert, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Really interesting. And I think we'll wrap it up there.
Okay, guys. Thanks very much, everybody. Thank you, Doug. Thanks, David and Sherry.
Thank you, Robert.
And good luck with the Miami opening up.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.